Hello. I should start by apologizing for the fact that I am giving this talk in English, but I can assure you that if I tried to give it to you in Portuguese, I would owe you a much larger apology. My subject today is law without the state. I want to talk about that subject first in the context of your daily life as you now live it, because there are things that really are forms of law other than what we usually think of as law. I then want to go on to talk about how in many societies, past and present, there were forms of law that were... Thank you. Let me figure out which... That's not on my screen, and it is on that screen. Just a minute. Here's one part. One thing that might be... And just a minute. Let's see if I can figure out what's going on. No, I can't. Let's see if this now works all right. All right. I don't know what was happening, but it seems to have stopped happening. All right. I want to discuss how in many past and some present societies, the function that is provided by law in the societies you're familiar with was handled by a private and decentralized mechanism. I then want to go on to talk about the future, first in real space, in the physical space we live in, how one might have a modern version of those societies of private law. And then I want to talk about private law in cyberspace, because I want to argue that something like what I am describing is in the process of developing online and may continue to do so. Let me start with private law as it now exists around us. The most familiar form consists of systems of private norms, of rules of individual behavior that are enforced by social pressure. Thus, for example, it would not violate any law of the United States if I were to teach a class naked to my waist. It would, however, be a foolish thing for me to do because it would lower my reputation with students and fellow professors. I therefore wouldn't do it. Spending time in Brazil, it occurred to me that I have another example of the same pattern. I have discovered that the normal way in which a man and a woman greet each other in Brazil is to touch cheek to cheek and kiss the air. I admit that in the talk I gave yesterday, I noticed one couple who appeared to have been infected by American norms and were doing their kisses in a different form. But I imagine that if when I met a woman I'd never met before and she put up her cheek, I instead tried to kiss her on the lips, that would be a violation of Brazilian norms and would again be not illegal but imprudent. So those are examples of forms of rules which are enforced by social pressure but are in fact a form of law, even if we don't call it law. Another form of private law in the world as it now exists is arbitration among businesses that do business internationally. That is my understanding that most cases where firms have contracts with other firms in other countries, what those contracts are actually judged by is not the law of either country, but the rules of firms that sell the service of arbitrating disputes. So that's, again, a form of private law which already exists. Finally, I would point out that every family has its own system of private law. When my daughter was much younger than she now is, she put a sign on her door, which I should say is still there, and the sign said, "Becca's room, stay out." The sign was directed at her younger brother, and the enforcement mechanism was the threat not to play with him if he violated it. So those are all examples of forms of law that do not come from government. contrast those and what I will be discussing with the standard modern model of law. In that model, the law is made either by legislators or possibly by judges appointed by the government in some way, in the American or English common law system, or some mixture of the two. The detection and prosecution of offenses is done by government employees for criminal offenses. For civil offenses, for torts or breaches of contract, it is up to the victim to detect the offense, up to his lawyer to sue somebody, but the dispute is then resolved in government court, and the verdict is enforced by the government. I want to talk about a different model of law, one which I refer to as feud law, which has in fact existed in quite a number of societies, including some that still exist. It is a form of law enforcement that is private and decentralized. And it is historically common. I will argue that most existing legal systems seem to have started as systems of feud law and then build on top of that. And I should tell you that the word feud has no connection at all to the word feudal. I always worry when I call it feud law that people make this connection inside their head and say he's talking about medieval feudalism. I am not. It turns out that the only connection between the two words is they happen to sound similar, that their etymology is different. They come from different words in Proto-Indo-European, the language we believe that both your language and mine are descended from. They just sound the same. The logic of feud law is very simple. If you wrong me, I threaten to harm you unless you compensate me. In order for it to work, there are at least four different problems that a system of feud law has to solve. The first problem is that it needs some mechanism so that my threat is believable when you really did wrong me and isn't believable when you don't. In order that, as I like to put it, right makes might, so that I can't just use it for extortion. Second, we need some kind of a commitment mechanism, because when I threaten to harm you, your reply will be, if you harm me, I'll harm you. So we need some way of making it in my interest to go through with that threat, so you will believe it enough to agree to compensate me. And we need a commitment mechanism so good that it works even after I'm dead, because otherwise you solve the problem by killing me. The third thing you need is some mechanism to protect the weak, some way in which people who don't have access to enough physical force to believably make threats nonetheless get their rights protected. And the fourth thing it needs is a way of ending feud. Because you can imagine a case where I think you've wronged me and you don't think so, so you treat my threat of retaliation as extortion, you then threaten to retaliate for that, and you get what people imagine when they hear the word feud, but what actually happens very rarely in real feud society. So let me start out. I've got this one backwards. I should have edited it after the last time. This is supposed to be mechanisms for right makes might, but I wrote it the wrong way and forgot to change it after the last time I gave this talk. Hopefully I'll remember after this talk. So we want mechanisms such that right makes might. And I want to start with the first such society that I learned about quite a long time ago, which was Iceland about 1,000 years ago. The saga period runs from about 930 AD to about 1263 AD. Very interesting society. It produced an extraordinary amount of literature for a tiny society. We are talking about a population of about 50,000 people in a far corner of the world who wrote probably more than a dozen novels that are currently in print in English paperback translations. So that, I like to say, it's competitive with Pericles in Athens or Elizabethan England in terms of literary production per capita. But it's also interesting in a bunch of other ways, because it was a society which had a legislature, a legal code, and a system of courts, but no executive arm of government, no government enforcement of the law. Once you got your verdict, it was up to you to enforce it. Romanichal Gypsies, the main Romani group in England today, have what I like to describe as a primitive version of the Icelandic system of 1,000 years earlier. The basic logic of their system is that if I think you have wronged me, I threaten to beat you up. And you and I know that if you really did wrong me according to the views of our society, the norms of that little sub-society within England, if you really wronged me, your friends won't support you and my friends will support me. So if you really wronged me, you either compensate me or leave town. And that's essentially a much simpler version. The Icelanders actually had courts and a law code that they could appeal to, but ultimately it was the threat of private force that made that system work. The Somali system, the system in the northern part of what's now Somalia, Somaliland, which had a stateless legal system for a very long time. People talk about Somalia as a terrible place. The actual history is that the northern part of Somalia was theoretically under English control and the southern part Italian control. The northern part, at least, they mostly left alone. And some point around 1960, Italy and England pulled out, but before they pulled out, they set up a centralized modern democratic government for a society that had never had anything of that sort. I think it took about 6 years for that to turn into a military dictatorship. The military dictator started a war with Ethiopia, which was the traditional enemy of the Somalis. The Soviet Union had initially backed the Somalis but switched sides. The war went badly. The dictator got killed. Somalia started sliding back towards traditional system, and the United States and the United Nations decided that Somalia needed a government. And ever since then, we have been trying to impose a government on a traditionally stateless society using the Ethiopian army to do it. I will let you figure out for yourself how Brazilians would react to someone deciding to reorganize their society and using whoever they thought of as their traditional enemies. I suppose nowadays you have traditional enemies only in football to do it with. So the Somali system, there were essentially ad hoc courts. There were traditional mechanisms by which when you had a dispute, there was a way of agreeing on judges, setting up a court, settling the issue, and there was then a great deal of social pressure to go along with the court verdicts, and otherwise people wouldn't help you. All of these are systems which solve two different problems. First is the problem of preventing the use of claims you've been injured to extort from people, to make them pay money they don't really owe you. And the second is the problem that people have observed for a long time, that everybody is a biased judge in his own case. So if I am deciding whether you've wronged me and owed money, I will be very, very generous to myself in concluding that anything I didn't like wronged me, and that you owe me lots of money. So you need some mechanism in which neutral third parties get brought in to make the decision. If they don't, my use of force will be seen as bad behavior by other people who will regard me as a dangerous person they don't want to associate with. Maybe they want to defend my victim against me. So in the Icelandic case, what determined whether you could use force was basically whether you won the court case. If you won the court case, it said that the other person owed you a certain amount of silver. If he didn't pay, the court would declare him an outlaw. Once he was an outlaw, it was legal to kill him, and it was tortious to defend him. If anybody defended him, they could themselves be sued. So it was a system in which the force was all private, but the existence of a court system determined when you could actually get away with using force. For details of these systems, I have a book that I have not yet published commercially, but the draft of it is up on my webpage for comments, and it's a book on legal systems very different from ours. A few of them are the sort of stateless system I'm describing. The others range from Imperial China through Periclean Athens to modern Amish and Romani. I think it's quite a lot of fun, and you are welcome to read it if you like. It's webbed on my site, which is daviddfriedman.com, and contains quite a lot of my writing that you can read for free. So the first problem was arranging that right makes might. The second was setting up commitment mechanisms so that when I threaten to harm you, you will believe I'll go through with it. It turns out that the original solution to this problem predates the human species. People will sometimes tell you that property is a creation of the government, creation of the state. This is sometimes an argument for saying you shouldn't complain if the government takes your stuff, but it's only your stuff because the government has laws that define property. We know this is not true, because we know that property in a primitive form existed before humanity existed. That territorial behavior is a pattern of behavior observed mostly in various species of birds and fishes, although there are some territorial animals, mammals. Indeed, I would argue that humans are territorial mammals. And the basic way territorial behavior works is that one individual somehow marks the area he is claiming, and he, as it were, turns a switch in his brain such that he will fight more and more desperately against the trespasser of his own species the farther into his territory the trespasser comes. And the essential fact that makes this work is that a fight to the death is usually a loss for both. Unless the trespasser is much larger and stronger, even if he wins the fight, he's likely to be injured. And it isn't worth it for the payoff of being able to do a little bit of gathering of whatever they eat on someone else's territory. So that's the simplest and earliest form of property. I would argue that a large part of human institutions, not just property, but rights in general, can be seen as a greatly elaborated version of that same tactic, that rights depend on the fact that if there are certain things that the people do to you, you are willing to bear unreasonably large costs to stop them. That's the subject of another talk, which I'm not giving here, but you can find it on my webpage, like many other things. Humans have an internalized commitment mechanism of their own, which we call vengefulness. That when somebody injures you, you very much want to get back at them. And some people think of vengefulness as an irrational characteristic of human beings, but you can also think of it as a rational characteristic provided to us by evolution, because if other members of your species know that if they harm you, you'll go to a lot of trouble to get back at them, they have a reason not to harm you. Furthermore, there are a set of reasons within human society why once you have made the threat, you are committed to carry it out. For one thing, if you don't, other people will say, we can harm him, we can violate his rights freely. He's a wimp. When faced by opposition, he backs down, so there's no reason not to take his stuff or not to do other things to him. Furthermore, human beings care about status. They care about how other people look at them. And you lose status if you appear to be a wimp. If somebody in some way wrongs you and you say, I'll beat you up if you don't compensate me, and he says, I don't believe you, and you go away, you're going to lose status among other humans. And success in rights enforcement gains status. That one of the patterns you observe in a number of such societies, and the two examples I know are the Comanche Indians, who were a stateless society, though not a very attractive one, and the Icelanders, is that you sometimes get volunteer enforcers. You sometimes get a case where somebody isn't strong enough to believably threaten someone, so some tough guy says, I'll do it for you. And his incentive to do that is to gain status, to show that he can face down the person who's your opponent. There's one of the Icelandic sagas, Hrafnkell saga, where that happens. Finally, we need a mechanism to make the commitment last through death. In the Icelandic case, the answer is that when somebody kills you, they then owe damage payments of 200 ounces of silver, what the Icelanders call wergeld, man gold, the damage payment, the tort damage for killing. That claim was inherited by your heirs. They would like 200 ounces of silver, so they have an incentive to enforce the claim, and they have a further incentive to make it clear that killing their relatives is a bad thing to do. It's a dangerous thing to do. So that was one way of doing it. The Somali have an interesting and elaborate system in which everybody is part of a nested set of coalitions. You have a group of people who are to some extent defined by kinship, but to some extent by explicit contract, who have agreed that if the rights of any of them are violated, the rest will help them collect their damage payment. That if any of them ends up still owing a damage payment, the others will help pay it. And I described it as a nested set of coalitions, because if it turns out that the opposition is too strong, you shift up to the larger coalition this coalition is a part of. So it's quite a fascinating and elaborate system. If you want to know about it, you can read the chapter on my web book that I'm still trying to publish, which describes Somalia, or if you really want to know about it, I have references there to the work of a British anthropologist who had been studying Somalia since the 1950s. Next problem is, how do you protect the weak? And my favorite solution in this is the Icelandic solution. We imagine that I'm an elderly man, I have one son, and somebody kills him. Legally speaking, I'm entitled to go to the court, sue him, and collect 200 ounces of silver damages. But it's pretty clear that if I try to do that, I'll get beaten up on the way to the court. That I don't have the physical force to enforce my claim. And the Icelandic solution is that under the Icelandic legal system, tort claims are marketable. They are transferable. My neighbor has four tough sons who went a Viking in their youth and lost their friends and relatives and allies. So I transfer my claim to him. He enforces the claim. He enforces 200 ounces. He collects 200 ounces of silver. Or if the man doesn't pay, he gets outlawed and he kills him. And if he collects 200 ounces of silver and it's not too hard, I may end up getting some of that money. Even if I don't, it has at least been established that it's a bad idea to kill my son, because you will end up facing someone more powerful than I am. So that was an ingenious system for protecting the weak. I like to argue that modern legal systems, such as the American legal system, would work better if we made tort claims transferable, and I like to say that in this respect, modern American law is a mere 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology. The Somali solution I described earlier, that you are part of what's called a diapaying group, a group defined by a combination of kinship and contract. The members of that group share the obligation to enforce claims. How do you end feud? If you end up with a situation we sometimes imagine, where you do something that I think wrongs me, I ask for compensation, you refuse, I retaliate, you now retaliate against me back and forth, how do we get out of it? And the problem is that if either of us gives up, he looks like a winner. Right? The solution in the Icelandic system is that we choose an arbitrator, we find some powerful person with a good reputation, we both agree to accept his view of the dispute, his decision of which of us owes what to whom. Now, if the arbitrator rules against me, the fact that I agree to pay you damages doesn't make me a winner. After all, I agreed to the arbitrator. The fact he said it probably means I really did owe the damages. On the other hand, if I refuse to agree to the arbitrator's verdict, now I've got a new enemy, namely the arbitrator, who we selected because he was a powerful person. So that was a way in which feuds got terminated. And if you look at the Icelandic sagas, people tend to think of the society as violent because the violent parts make the good story. But if you really try to go through them, it looks as though most of the conflict settled very quickly. The Somali solution for settling it, as I mentioned before, one solution is a mechanism for bringing up a court, and once you accept the court verdict, you're safe. But the other one, which I really liked as an economist, was there was a situation where there was where violence was getting too high, where they were worried about it. And so the clans whose members were engaged in this violence both agreed to raise the price for killing people. They both agreed that the damage payment you ended up paying after you killed somebody would be higher than the traditional level. And as any economist can tell you, if you raise the price of something, people buy less of it. So that was a way of reducing the violence. One of the societies I haven't mentioned yet are the Finnish gypsies, the Kale. They're a fascinating society. They may be the only society in the world that has no institution of marriage and, for official purposes, does not believe in the facts of human reproduction. They nonetheless manage to reproduce. They're still there. And again, you can read a description of how that society works in my draft, or you can go to the book on Gypsy Law that has a whole chapter on them based on the work of a Finnish anthropologist. Quite a fascinating society. But they have feuds. Their feuds are not between individuals but between families. And typically, if the feud seems to keep going, what they do is to start avoiding each other. So the members of each family just have nothing to do with the members of the other family. If you never see each other, you aren't going to clash. You aren't going to have a reason to want to fight. And they keep that up for a generation or so until everybody has forgotten that there's a feud, and then they can start doing business again. All right, I guess I have more details than I thought I did. This is just running through what I just said. All right, that's what I just said. I didn't remember that the second slide had all the details. All right, finally, I want to, not finally for this chunk of it, I want to argue that feud systems appear to underlie many legal systems. In the case of Anglo-American common law, it's pretty clear, because Anglo-American common law developed out of Anglo-Saxon law, and Anglo-Saxon law, until about its last century, was basically Icelandic law plus a king. I should say, I don't know if Brazilians study Icelandic history, most people don't, but what happens with Iceland is that somebody decides to be king of Norway. Norway has been a bunch of very small kingdoms with very weak kings, and a man called Harald decided to change that. He eventually conquered all of the other small kingdoms, set up a much stronger monarchy, and the people who didn't like that left Norway and settled Iceland. That, at least, is the Icelandic account of the initial settlement. So that's one which comes out of a feud system, namely one like the Icelandic. Jewish law is possibly the best documented legal system in the history of the world. That we've got a treatise that's a thick book from nearly 2,000 years ago. We have got hundreds of thousands of the equivalent of legal cases, what are called responses, that has survived. And we've got lots of treatises written since. So it's quite a lot of fun to try to make sense of how that system works. But one of the things I observe in it is what I think of as fossilized feuds, as characteristics of the institutions that suggest that you started out with a feud system and then build on top of it. In rabbinic law, if you kill somebody, what you're supposed to do is to go to one of the cities of refuge. This is in the kingdom of Israel as it existed roughly 2,000 years ago. There were certain cities of refuge. You are escorted from there to a court in the city where the killing occurred. The court tries you. If they decide it's the equivalent of first-degree murder, you are executed. And you are executed by the avenger of blood. Who is the avenger of blood? The heir of the man you killed. That is, the man who, in a feud system, would have had the responsibility for avenging or getting damage payments for his father. Furthermore, it is illegal in rabbinic law for the avenger of blood to accept money payments, not to execute you. Well, you make laws against things because people are doing them, and that looks as though you had a Wehrgeld system where one of the possible responses to a killing was a money settlement, and they were trying to prevent it. Furthermore, if they decide that it's not first-degree murder, they decide that it's something like manslaughter, say, you then are escorted back to the city of refuge, and you have to remain there until the high priest dies. So it's an exile of uncertain terms. If you go outside of the city of refuge, you can be killed by the Avenger of Blood. And if he catches you on your way to the city of refuge, he can kill you. So again, it looks as though you're starting out with a feud system and modifying it. There are some other elements which I won't go into, which also look like fossilized feuds. Islamic law, people call it Sharia, but I think that's a mistake. As best I can tell, what Sharia really is law as it exists in the mind of God. And that law, as Islamic courts enforced it, was called fiqh, which is usually translated as jurisprudence. There are, in Sunni Islam, four different schools of law. They are mutually orthodox. They don't regard each other as heretical, because all of them know that they don't know for certain what the law ought to be. They're trying to do their best to deduce it from the Quran and the traditions of what Muhammad did and said. They disagree in detail, but agree on most things. One feature of Islamic law is a part of it called jinniyat, which is the part of Islamic law that deals with injuring or killing somebody. Injuring or killing somebody is not treated as a crime against the state. It is treated as a tort against the victim. So if you are injured, you are entitled to collect damages based on the injury. And if you are killed, your kin, your heirs, are entitled either, if it's first-degree murder, to retaliate, to kill the person who killed you, or if they prefer, instead of retaliation, they can collect diya, which is the Islamic equivalent of wergeld, a payment in camels, not in silver, for killing somebody. And if the court rules that the case is less than first-degree murder, they are still entitled to a diya, but they don't have the alternative of insisting on killing you. So I should say there's one other penalty, and that is that although killing is not an offense against the state, it is an offense against God. And therefore, if you kill somebody, you are supposed to either free one Islamic slave, one Muslim who is a slave, or else fast for 2 months. That doesn't kill you. The Islamic fast is only that you cannot eat, drink, or have sex in daylight. So for part of the day. That's the same as the Ramadan fast, for those who are familiar with it. So that looks an awful lot as though you're starting out with a Bedouin feud system. Muhammad is trying to impose a court system on it, but the court system leaves a good deal of the characteristics of the feud system with it. Roman law, which is probably what your legal system ultimately descends from. I don't know a lot about Brazilian law, but most of the European systems, other than the English, ultimately come from Roman law, sometimes through the Code Napoleon in France. So my guess is that your legal system ultimately comes from Roman law. We don't know as much about early Roman law as about the other systems I've described. The earliest sort of official body of law was something called the Law of the Twelve Tables, what they thought of as their constitution. It has not survived, which is surprising. People have tried to reconstruct it because parts of it are quoted in various things that did survive. It looks as though it has some evidence of a pre-existing system of victims and self-enforcing their rights. And the earliest forms of Roman law that we really know about in the early Republic are ones in which the victim is playing a large role. It's up to the victim to basically forcibly get the person who has wronged him to the court, and eventually the verdict is going to involve the victim in effect owning the person who wronged him to kill him or sell him into slavery, assuming there's no lesser result in it. So it looks again as though the early Roman system was probably a feud system. I'm less certain about that. I don't know enough about early Chinese law to offer an opinion or about other systems. Those are the ones I know something about. So that's my summary of the part of law without government that represents feud systems. Some of them still exist. The Romanichal that I mentioned is still happening, it's an unofficial, it's an illegal legal system, but it is one of a number of examples where you have what I think of as embedded law. You've got some community which is within a society's conventional law, but does a good enough job of staying below the radar of the official system so they are able to enforce their own rules on their own members. And that's actually true, it turns out, of a number of the Romani societies. I discuss that in the book, but I'm not going to go into more detail here. I now want to talk about law without government in the future. This was the subject of my first book. If you want to read it, the second edition is webbed as a free PDF on my webpage. And what I was trying to do was to imagine, as somebody who believes in getting government out of things and privatizing things, what would happen if you carried that approach all the way. If you tried to replace all useful things the government does by private mechanisms. Now, many of the things the government does are not useful, so replacing them is really easy. You replace it with nothing. Some of them are things that are useful things, but where the government has no advantage at all in doing them, like education. Indeed, government has a disadvantage, that the reason governments shouldn't run schools is the same reason they shouldn't run the newspapers and the printing presses. We want to have a free press so the government doesn't tell grown-ups what's true. We'd like to have a free school system so it doesn't tell children what's true. But then there are the sort of, what we think of as the core functions, which are basically rights enforcement, settling disputes among people, preventing theft, robbery, murder and such. So I was trying to imagine a private legal system that would substitute for that. I didn't know about feud law. This was a book that I wrote about 45 years ago. I've now concluded that to some extent I was reinventing the wheel, that what I was describing was a modern division of labor, developed society version of the sort of thing that had existed in the past in much simpler systems. So how does my system work? There are private firms that are selling the service of protecting their customers' rights and settling their disputes. Each customer chooses to be, each individual chooses to be the customer of such a firm. And then there's an obvious potential problem, which everybody who hears about this says this is why it won't work, and that is what happens when I believe you have stolen my television, you deny it, and we have different rights enforcement agencies. So I think you stole my television because my rights enforcement agency installed a video camera that showed you walking out my door with my television. When my firm says to you, bring back the television, you say, what television? Never saw Mr. Friedman in my life. Never saw Mr. Friedman's television. I have this nice television a friend gave me. And my rights enforcement agency says, we're sorry you feel that way. Four of our big tough guys are going to show up at your front door tomorrow to take the television back. And you reply, well, that's too bad, but I do have a rights enforcement agency. And I will call them, and if four thugs show up at my front door, six righteous defenders of my rights will be there to stop them. That's the story everybody thinks is going to happen. The result is violent conflict, but it's not really a very likely story, because violence is very bad business. That if we settle conflict by violence, both firms are going to have to pay more to their employees for the risk of getting killed. The customers are going to have their front yard turned into a free fire zone, which is not really what you want if you want your rights protected. And furthermore, nobody will know when his rights will or won't be protected because it depends who wins the fight. So there ought to be a better solution, and there is. And the better solution is that the two firms agree to select a private court, an arbitrator, and to accept its judgment. And of course, they agree not just for this dispute. They know perfectly well that this same scenario is going to happen over and over again because they have customers in the same area who interact with each other. And therefore, they agree that any time there is a conflict between their customers, both sides will accept the verdict of the private court they have agreed on. And then the question you ought to be asking is, well, they agree to that, but what enforces that agreement? Because this is a world without a government. So you sign a contract, that's a nice pretty piece of paper, what makes you obey it? And the answer is that what makes you obey it is that they are repeat players. that they are subject to what is sometimes called the discipline of constant dealing. Each of them knows that if, when his customer loses the case, they refuse to go along, the next time when the other one's customer loses the case, he won't go along. We're back fighting each other instead of arbitrating. That will be doing a very bad job. It'll be very expensive, and we'll lose all of our customers to some other rights enforcement agencies that settle their disputes peaceably. So that's a reason why we would expect that that contract, even with no government to enforce it, will be self-enforcing. And in fact, if you think about the real world, we see a lot of self-enforcing contracts of various forms where it doesn't pay to violate a contract for some kind of reputational reason. Who makes the law in this system? And the answer is that the law is being provided on the free market, and the firms that generate the law are the arbitration agencies, the private courts. That the legal rules of the arbitration agency are part of the package it is selling to the rights enforcement agency when the rights enforcement agency agrees to pay the court to settle their dispute. The rules of the rights enforcement agency they choose are part of the package that the enforcement agency is selling to its customers. That if you are our customer, and if you have a dispute with a customer of that agency, here's the law that will apply. Now, this is not a system where the law always applies in all cases. It might be that we have agreed with that agency to one court and that agency to another court. There's going to be some market pressure for the courts to have roughly similar rules. Makes life easier for everybody, but they don't in principle have to. And they shouldn't even, because there may be some people in some areas who have a reason to want, let us say, detailed water law, law on who can draw water from a river, which is a nuisance in other areas where there's lots of water and the only problem is what to do with it. So you would like a certain amount of, as it were, tailoring the laws for the customers. But between any two agencies, you've got law defined. The rights enforcement agencies want law that their customers want to live under, because that way they get customers and can charge them more money for providing a quality of service they want. So that means that you have law which is, as it were, designed to maximize the welfare of the customers as judged by them. All right? So if you imagine that somebody says, look, why don't we change the law in the following way? Why don't we decide on some different laws or different rules of evidence, or decide that some things that used to be illegal won't be illegal, or that used not to be illegal will be illegal? If that's a change that the customers of both agencies on the whole like, if each agency says we will get more customers or be able to charge higher rates if we have that change, then it's easy. The rights enforcement agency makes the change. Everybody's happy. The harder case is the one where you have a change which on average the customers of one agency want and the customers of the other agency don't want. But in that case, you could imagine each agency engaging in some market research. So the example I used in my book originally is the death penalty. Suppose the customers of one agency are people who are worried that they might be convicted of a killing, whether or not they actually did it, and get executed. Or else there are people who feel, even if I'm killed, I don't want my killer to be executed. That's a barbarous thing to do. For whatever reason, we can imagine that the customers of one agency would prefer a court that does not have a death penalty. The customers of the other agency, the other way around, they say, I want to make sure nobody kills me. If people know they'll be executed, if they kill me, they won't kill me. So they want a law with the death penalty. So we could imagine each agency doing some market research to find out how much the rule is worth to their customers. If it turns out that the agency whose customers are against the death penalty could get $2 million more dollars a year in fees from those customers if they could guarantee no death penalty in conflicts with that agency, and the one on the other side can only get $1 million a year more by getting what their people want, then you have a side payment. One agency pays the other something between $1 and $2 million, and they agree on no death penalty. So you have a mechanism in which the market, in effect, is evaluating how much it is worth to each group of people to get the rules they want, and then tending to generate the rules which maximize the total benefit. The result for the any economist in the room is the pattern of rules that is what we would refer to as economically efficient. The pattern of rules that maximizes the sun benefit. Now, if there are any really good economists in the room, you will realize that I'm oversimplifying for a bunch of reasons, one of which I'll discuss later, but at least the right first approximation is that we're generating a economically efficient set of laws. Let's compare that to the alternative of the kind of system we're used to, a democratic society where law is made by the legislature or possibly by the judges, at least interpreted by the judges. In that system, there is no good mechanism to get good law. That from the standpoint, the sort of story we tell our children is that the reason democracy works is that the government has to do the right thing or else we'll vote them out. In order for that to work, the individual voter has to know what the government is doing and what it should be doing. For some reason, no candidate ever runs on the platform, "I am the bad guy." I do not believe anybody has ever introduced into the U.S. Congress a bill labeled a bill to make farmers richer and city folks poorer. Now, it happens that such a bill is introduced into Congress every session. It's called the Agriculture Bill, the Farm Bill. Its purpose is to make farm products more expensive in order to raise the income of farmers at the expense of everybody else. But the people who argue for it always find some way of pretending it's in everybody's interest. So in order for the simple model of democracy to work, each individual has to go to quite a lot of trouble to figure out what the politicians are really doing and what they should be doing, which again is not obvious. The question is, why would you bother given that it's a lot of work? Because the individual voter in a large society like Brazil or the U.S. knows that his vote has almost no chance of changing the outcome of a national election. He knows that if it does, by a 1 in 10 million chance, change the outcome, he'll get a little bit of the benefit of a better politician and the rest will be divided with the rest of his society. So it does not pay him individually to actually go to the effort unless he happens to find politics entertaining and treats it as a hobby rather than a rational self-interested activity. So since he does not have an incentive to know either what he has no incentive to determine what the law is or how it's enforced or to know it, why pay the cost? Furthermore, even if he wants to know which politician is better, it's very hard to find out because he doesn't get to compare the alternatives. He doesn't get to see how well off is America if Obama wins the election compared to how well off it would have been if McCain won the election, because only one of them wins. The most he can do is to compare the Bush administration to the Obama administration. But after all, Obama did not have somebody crash an airplane into a tall building in New York. Obama faced a different set of problems than Bush. You can always, if things go badly, explain that if things go badly for your administration, you can always explain it's because of the difficult circumstances. If they go well for the next administration, you always say they were just lucky they had an easy set of problems. So there's no very easy way of doing comparison shopping across political parties or politicians. On the market, on the other hand, if you are buying a car, you can test drive different cars, you can read consumer reports, you can talk to friends who have other cars, you can in many ways evaluate it, and in the system I'm describing, you can evaluate the services provided by different rights enforcement agencies. You can ask your cousin, who's the customer of a different agency, when somebody robbed him, how fast did the private police show up? When he got into a law case, how easily and quickly was it settled? How expensive was the lawyer? Was he happy with the result? You can't get everything you want, of course, in this world, but you can at least come much closer because your decision of which rights enforcement agency to be a customer of determines which rights enforcement agency you're under, whereas your decision of whether to vote for Obama or McCain does not determine whether it's Obama or McCain who is your president. All right? So it is therefore a system in which the mechanism for generating good law is, I want to argue, much better than it would be in a governmental political system. Now, I assume that at least some of you think of yourselves as libertarians or as liberals in the Brazilian sense, which of course is the correct sense of liberal. I like to say that in the roughly early 20th century in America, the enemies of liberalism stole its name, and they still got it. And that's why we had to steal the term libertarian from the left anarchists, so that we would have a label for ourselves. But from the standpoint of those of you who think of yourselves as libertarians or as liberals, a question you should ask is whether the legal system produced by the market will in fact be a libertarian legal system. Because after all, the argument I'm offering so far is not that it will be in the interest of the arbitration agencies to do the morally correct thing, but it's in their interest to do the thing that maximizes the benefit of the customers. If you think about the logic of the system, they roughly imply that you will get economic efficiency, but we don't know if that will be law that respects liberty. And the answer is that on some circumstances it won't be. That if enough people in the society are willing to pay enough for an oppressive law, the market will provide it. I like to say, imagine a society where almost everybody agrees that having heroin is a terrible thing to do, and they therefore want to make sure that anyone anywhere close to them is taking heroin, he can be thrown in jail. In that society, market law will have heroin illegal. Of course, in that society, democratic law will also have heroin illegal. The only difference is that you have to have a much stronger view against heroin in the market system, because if you have a society where some people are somewhat against heroin, and some people are think it ought to be legal, and some people want to use it, the people who want to use it are going to be willing to pay much more, as it were, to get the law they want, because it's much more important for them. But it's certainly possible in this system to have law I disapprove of. On the other hand, one of the reasons that we are libertarians is that we believe that liberty works. We believe that on the whole, a society where individual rights are respected will not only be freer, it will be more prosperous, people will be healthier, they will be happier, it will work better. That one can say in principle that we should do the right thing whatever the consequences. But oddly enough, almost nobody believes that the thing he thinks is right really has bad consequences. I haven't yet met any libertarians who believe that if we have a libertarian society, everybody will be poor and hungry. And I haven't met any socialists who believe that if we have a socialist society, everybody will be poor and hungry. Somehow we all manage to persuade ourselves, I hope correctly in our case, that what we want is also good. So if that's right, then liberty is generally economically efficient. It makes people better off. It is rarely worth as much to me to violate your rights as to you to not have your rights violated. And we would therefore expect that, as a general rule, the law produced by market anarchy will tend to be libertarian law, not necessarily perfectly. In making the comparison between anarchy and government, the mistake a lot of people make in argument is to think you're arguing about the what results you want rather than what results you will get. So that somebody says, we need a government to help the poor. But that's assuming that if you have a government, it will help the poor. And if you look at real-world societies, you see that generally governments buy the votes of the poor by doing things for the poor that the not-poor pay for. And then they buy the votes of the not-poor by doing things for the not-poor that the poor and other people pay for. And it is very far from clear, at least if I look at the society I know best, which is the one I live in, America, it's not at all clear that on net, the poor are in fact gaining rather than losing by the government interventions. I would guess that they are on net losing. So from that standpoint, the question you always want to ask is not describe an outcome and assume your system produces it, but describe an outcome if you like, but then describe your institutions and figure out what results those institutions will actually produce. So don't ask what laws you want from government, but what laws you expect to get from government and from anarchy, because the same thing is true. I don't get to say, I won't cause an anarchy if it has laws against heroin, because my anarchy might produce laws against heroin. The best I can do is to say, here's why it usually won't, or at least is less likely to than the government. All right. Under anarchy, The people who produce law have an incentive to produce good law. The people who enforce law have an incentive to do it well. Under government, neither is true. And therefore, just like the comparison between market and government in producing cars or food, we can expect a market for law to do a better job of producing law and law enforcement. Having said that, there are a number of potential problems with the system I'm describing. One of them is the problem of defending against the nation, against a government that wants to take over your stateless area. Because the problem is that defense against the nation is what economists call a public good. It's a good such that the producer cannot control who gets it. So if second problem is the risk of cartelization of the rights enforcement industry. What happens if the rights enforcement agencies get together and decide to turn themselves into a government and collect taxes instead of fees? And the third problem, the most interesting one to economists, is what I refer to as market failure on the market for law. Situations in which the market for law suffers from problems such as externalities, which we expect to result in ordinary markets sometimes giving the wrong outcome. So let me start with national defense. The problem with national defense is that if I stop an invasion or shoot down a missile, everybody else in the area shares the benefit. There's no way that I can have an anti-missile that only targets missiles aiming at me. Since it's costly to defend, since most of the benefit goes to other people, I don't have the simple market solution of if you want it, pay for it. All right? On the other hand, we know that some public goods do get produced privately. I don't know about what the norms are in Brazil, but in the U.S., if you get a taxi cab ride or if you get a meal in a restaurant, you are expected to tip the provider, roughly 10%, 15%, depending on how generous you are. You also expect that if the service is really bad, you don't tip them. And if you think the cab driver did a really bad job of getting you from here to there, you don't tip him. This is an incentive mechanism, which makes it in the interest of waiters and cab drivers to do a good job. But it's also a public good. I don't expect to ride in that cab again. So when I pay by tipping the cab driver, I'm producing a benefit for everybody else who's going to ride in that cab in the future. And that's one example, and there are others, in which systems of norms result in people voluntarily paying for a public good. There are other ways. Charity is a way in which we pay for public goods. When you contribute money to the Red Cross, it's not because you'll get a benefit, it's because you think it's a good thing. And there are also indirect benefits. There are ways in which, along with producing a public good, you also produce private goods. And one example, which I find particularly interesting, is how you have political movements or volunteer groups to do good things. Because if you have a club that's trying to introduce liberty into Brazil, you know that your individual activity has only a small effect. If you succeed, you only get a small part of the benefit. So if you think of working for liberty as sort of like planting fruit trees and then eating the fruit, it doesn't work very well. You're bearing all of the cost of your activity, getting a small part of the benefit. On the other hand, while you're working for liberty, you're doing it with other people. These are people who share your values. These are people who are working with you in a common project. Hence, these are people who may end up as your friend, your lover, maybe even your wife or husband. So one of the ways of looking at how lots of voluntary activities, not just political ones, actually work is that part of the incentive is the side benefit of the social benefit. That's why when I give a talk like this while I'm waiting for it to start, I count the audience and I try to figure out what percentage is women. Because one of the problems with the libertarian movement is that the men outnumber the women. That means that the potential benefits are less. That a healthy movement, you figure it's about 40-60 one way or the other, somewhere in that range. So that one of the things you are doing along with saving the world is mate search, which is one of the main activities human beings engage in. Some years ago, I gave a series of talks in Europe. My wife was counting the audience, and her estimate was it was about 10%. And one of the reasons I like Students for Liberty in America is that they seem to be up around 30 or 40%, which is a much healthier situation. I should say the one country I've ever been in where the women libertarians outnumbered the men was the country of Georgia. And I proposed to them that they ought to be exporting female libertarians to the libertarian movement of other countries. But let me give you one other example of indirect benefit. My webpage has the full text of about 4 or 5 of my books. It has the full text of most of my articles. And it has links to many speeches I've given, either audio recordings, I've got my phone recording this at the moment, or video recordings, and people set that up and web it. All of that is being given away for free, because the World Wide Web is a rather clumsy tool for selling information, but a beautiful tool for giving it away. The result of giving it away is that nice people invite me to come to Brazil and offer to pay the cost to me of coming to Brazil, pay my hotel expenses, meet me at the airport and help me find my hotel, in general give me a nice 2-week vacation in Brazil, which is really a side benefit that I am getting by putting stuff up on my webpage. For a discussion of ways in which we could do the equivalent of this for national defense, which I regard as the hardest problem for a stateless society, see my first book. I have one chapter in the first edition and another chapter in the third edition discussing possible indirect ways of providing defense for a stateless society. All right. Second problem is what I think of as the cartelization problem, and that is, if you imagine only 3 rights enforcement agencies, they might make a deal. We won't accept your customers if they want to change. You won't accept ours. We now have people with no other alternatives, so we can raise the price. If they don't like the price, we can arrest them because they no longer have anybody to protect their rights. So that's a potential problem, basically the reinvention of government. What's the point of getting rid of one government if you get another? That, as an economist will tell you, is going to depend on how many agencies there are. That if there are 2 or 3 firms, forming a cartel is often practical. If there are 100 firms, there aren't, because when a few of them start getting together, then the others just take their customers away by not mistreating the customers. So the question is, how large are economies of scale in the rights enforcement business? Do you end up with only a few very large firms, or is it a kind of business like many businesses where small firms can outcompete large firms, but large firms have too many levels between the president and the factory floor, so to speak? If you end up with 100 agencies, it probably is pretty safe. If you end up with 3, it may not be. Third problem is what I refer to as market failure on the market for law. Consider the case of air pollution. Suppose the question that my agency is bargaining with your agency about is whether you can sue me for the fact that my steel mill is putting sulfur dioxide into the air, which is blowing down to where you live. The amount that it's worth to me to get the rule where you can't sue me is basically the cost to me of controlling the pollution, or alternatively the damages I would owe. The benefit to you is the value to you of controlling the pollution. However, if you get it your way, not only will you benefit, people downwind who are customers of other rights enforcement agencies will also benefit, because if you can sue me for pollution, I won't pollute as much, and they'll get cleaner air. So that's the case where the amount offered for the 2 different rules does not accurately represent the value to those affected, because there's an external benefit to third parties. So therefore, you would not expect to get a perfectly economic efficient legal rule for anything that has those characteristics. My other example involves intellectual property, a slightly more complicated example, but I run through it in my book. So more generally, if the legal rule between A and B has major effects on C, and C is a customer of a different agency, those effects will get ignored in the bargaining that generates the law, and you will therefore get an inefficient level of legal rules. On the other hand, we have no mechanism at all giving us an efficient level of legal set of legal rules without the market, with the political one. So I would argue that this is a way in which the market outcome is less good than the ideal outcome that you get if God comes down and makes the law, but probably better than what you can expect from the usual alternative. All right. Is it all right if I go a little longer? All right, it's gone longer than I usually go. All right, I want to now go on to the version of this society that I actually expect to happen. The one I've described could happen eventually. It's worth, if you're going to argue for free markets, thinking through what happens if you carry that argument all the way. On the other hand, societies change very slowly. Everybody is used to having government. But I now want to talk about anarchy in cyberspace, because online it is a good deal more practical to move to this. And I want to start with the key technology, which most people are not aware of, but which is in fact a revolutionary technology developed a few decades ago, which is called public key encryption. How many people here know what public key encryption is? All right. Some, but most don't. That's usually the case. Suppose I want to send this gentleman a message, and I want to make sure that if that evil person in the front row intercepts the message, he can't read it. All right, the traditional way is that I have a key, a set of instructions for scrambling my message. I make sure he has a copy of the key, so I scramble the message, I send it to him, and he unscrambles it. The problem with that is that if I don't have a safe way of getting him messages, I may not have a safe way of getting him keys either. So if, while I am transmitting the key, this nice lady who is carrying the key to him just happens to slip a copy to him, now I send messages that I think are safe, but really aren't. All right? That's the problem with the old-fashioned way of doing encryption. Encryption is very important for privacy, especially online. You're sending messages through many intermediate steps. So there's always the chance that the National Security Agency or somebody else is intercepting your message, so it matters whether or not they can read it. Public key encryption is a mathematical procedure that generates a pair of keys, two long numbers, which have a mathematical relation to each other, but where you cannot deduce either one from the other. And the result of their relation is that if you scramble information with one of them, you need the other one to unscramble it, either direction. If you scramble with this key, you have to unscramble with that one. So what do? You produce a pair of keys. You then give away one of them. You make one of them your public key. You put it up on the web. You tell everybody in the world what it is. The other is your private key that nobody else ever gets. A stranger wants to send you a message and make sure the National Security Agency can't read it. They encrypt the message with your public key. They send it to you, you decrypt with the private key. If the National Security Agency has a copy of your public key, they can send you secret messages too. But they can't read the messages that were sent to you. So it's an extremely powerful technology. It's in practice used in more complicated ways than I'm describing in order to protect the privacy of information going across the Internet. It turns out that public key encryption actually produces a bunch of related benefits. Not only does it mean that anybody in the world can send you messages that nobody but you can read, it also means that you can send anybody else a message that nobody but you could have written. So suppose I want to prove who I am. Suppose, for example, that I am a conspirator. I'm trying to organize a conspiracy to overthrow the U.S. government and replace it with a free, stateless society. My fellow conspirators want to make sure that the instructions I send them are really from me and not from the FBI. The FBI is very active in conspiracies, as you may know. I'm told that at one time, maybe a majority of the members of the Communist Party of the U.S. were FBI agents. So I write my message. I encrypt it with my private key. I then encrypt it with your public key. I send it to you. You decrypt the first level with your private key. It says without encryption, this is from David Friedman, so you know who it's supposed to be. So you use my public key to decrypt it, and the fact that that worked means it was encrypted with my private key. All right? My public key is the one that matches my private key. So therefore, you know it came from me. So I now have a way in which I can prove my identity as the sender without you ever actually having to see me, talk to me, or anything of the sort. And indeed, I can prove not only my identity in real space, but I can prove a fictional identity in cyberspace. Let us suppose that because I'm trying to overthrow the government, I don't want to tell anybody that the person who is running the conspiracy is David Friedman. So I say, I have an online persona. That online persona has a public key that is published. The online persona does not tell anybody whether he's man or a woman, 20 or 80, or what continent he lives on. But other people in the conspiracy know that he's the person who's organizing the conspiracy. They can send me secret messages encrypted with my public key, and they can recognize my secret messages. So this actually gives you a technology that makes it possible to combine anonymity and reputation. You can have an online identity where nobody knows who in real space that person is, and yet you can prove that you are that online person. Very powerful technology. It turns out that it also gives you several other useful things. That the same technology makes it possible to prevent the authorities from knowing who is talking to whom. There is what are referred to as anonymous remailers, in which you take advantage of encryption to bounce a message through multiple remailers, stripping off one level of encryption at each stage so that nobody can tell that this message and this are the same because they look different. And the result is that unless all of the remailers are working for the FBI, the FBI has no way of knowing who is talking to whom. They can't do what's called traffic analysis in this context. There are also ways of using these technologies to produce anonymous digital cash such that you can pay people things without any observer, including the Internal Revenue Service, knowing what's happening. So it is very hard to tax or regulate things you can't see. Hence, the result of this system is a world of strong privacy. How do you enforce agreements? How do you do the equivalent of my rights enforcement agencies? And the answer is you do it using reputation, not using guns. So since we have this technology, I sign a contract with him. When we write the contract, we also include in the contract the name and the public key of the arbitrator we agree on. That contract we then both digitally sign. We encrypt it with both my private key and his private key. Each of us has a copy. Now, I happen to be a rogue, and so I break the contract. He was supposed to pay me to write a computer program. He pays me, and I never get around to writing the program. So he says, you give me the money back, and I say no. He goes to the arbitrator. The arbitrator examines what happened and says, all right, you owe him $1,000. In anonymous digital cash, of course, so maybe it's one Bitcoin. And if I don't pay, the arbitrator then writes his account of what happened. He digitally signs it. He creates a web page which has the original contract digitally signed by me, the arbitrator's verdict digitally signed by him, and my name all over it. Anybody who wants to do business with me does a search to find information online about me, finds that page, and now his computer in 2 seconds of analysis can check the digital signatures and tell him that I agreed to a contract. And according to the arbitrator I agreed to, I then broke the contract. So he knows not to do business with me. So we have a very powerful mechanism for establishing reputational enforcement online. What I'm describing is the sort of extreme high-tech version. But if you look at how the Internet currently functions, you can see less extreme versions of this happening all the time. That any time you make a purchase on eBay, you get to rate the seller, and if the seller has low ratings, nobody buys from them. I had an interesting experience a few years ago. I bought from Amazon an external battery for my laptop. It was a very powerful external battery. And I emailed the sellers before I bought it to check on whether there would be any problem with how powerful it was taking it on airplanes. And they said no. I then took it on a trip to China. On my way out of China, it was confiscated because it, in fact, was well above the limits of what the Chinese allow on an airplane because this was a lithium battery, and lithium batteries can burn. As any of you who own the previous version of the Samsung knows, lithium batteries can burn. Sometimes when you don't want them to. So I emailed the sellers, who by the way were Chinese, pointing out that I asked about the problem, or oversimplifying the exchange a little bit. They said not to worry, and sure enough, I lost the battery. And I put a review on Amazon describing what happened. And the sellers got back to me and said, we will be happy to replace your battery. Do you mind doing something about that review on Amazon? And so they replaced the battery. I revised the review on Amazon to say that this happened, but that they compensated me by replacing the battery. Everybody's happy. So that's a case where reputational enforcement online is working, not just in the science fiction stories I tell about how you could do it with the public key encryption, but in fact in the real world. All right. So therefore, it looks as though market anarchy may develop, and indeed is developing online, developing a system where the relevant rules are the rules that the arbitrators people agree on to settle their disputes, and where governments have very, very limited ability to control what people do. Suppose we end up with anarchy in cyberspace and government in real space, which may very well be the future that you are going to live in. In a world where most stuff happens online, where most people work online, where people spend their income mostly on buying digital goods. Now, digital goods could include medical services. If we've got good medical robots, so to speak, what you're really paying for is the connection to a doctor or to a computer that functions as a doctor to tell you what's wrong with you, maybe even to control the operation if we've got good enough distance-operated machines. So that means you could imagine a future where the food you buy still has to be actually produced in the real world, but where most of what you earn and most of what you spend is being done online. And if the idea of people spending their life online seems odd to you, you don't have any friends who are World of Warcraft enthusiasts. You could imagine a society where most of your socializing is done online, where most of the people who are your good friends are people you've never met. In that world, moving from one country to another is very easy. Because when you move from Brazil to the U.S., or from the U.S. to Iceland, or from Iceland to Estonia, you take your email and your URL with you. The result is that you still have your job, you still have your friends, you still have most of what you do. And if one government doesn't treat you right, you vote with your feet. So that would be a future in which governments still exist, but they're now just landlords. All they are doing is charging you to have a physical location on their territory, and that will tend to compete down to the cost of providing them since they're competing with other governments. For much more on all of this stuff, my website is www.davidgfriedman.com. It contains links to the Machinery of Freedom, the second edition. The third edition is a $2.99, I think, Kindle on Amazon. I write my books mainly to spread ideas, not mainly as a source of income. I like to say that when you're young, you're afraid people will steal your ideas. When you're old, you're afraid they won't. The book that I've more or less mostly finished and I'm looking for a publisher for at the moment is Legal Systems Very Different from Ours. The draft is webbed for comment on my site. My blog, where I talk about whatever I feel like talking about at the moment, is called Ideas, and it is davidgfriedman.blogspot.com, and if you do that in Brazil, you have a .dr at the end for some reason. So that's what I had to talk about today. Thank you all.
So David, nowadays governments are very big, and you have this idea that that the law will be more efficient. Why in the government the law is not as efficient? This system you okay doesn't work in government.
Because in government you do not get to choose who your rights provider is. Or rather you can choose that only at the high cost of moving from the U.S. to Brazil, learning to speak Portuguese, getting up all of your friends and your jobs, and so forth. So that government face some market pressure. If the government is bad enough, it's going to lose citizens and won't be able to tax them. I am told that about 10% of the population of Venezuela is no longer in Venezuela, but that's a very extreme case, and 90% are still there. So the mechanism for getting government to make efficient laws is supposed to be democracy. I went through why democracy is a very poor mechanism for getting government to make good laws, because the individual customers don't have an incentive to know whether they're getting good laws, don't have a good way of finding out if they're getting good laws, and don't have much control over what laws they get. And therefore, different mechanisms. If this were a different talk, I could discuss what determines what governments do do. That's public choice theory for an economist. That wasn't the subject of this talk. So we have only very weak mechanisms of using competition to control governments, whereas the system I'm describing, since governments are no longer territorial sovereigns, they no longer control a particular area, you therefore can change your rights provider without changing where you live. I don't see why. That is, everybody values having their rights protected. Even if you're rich and I'm poor, if I'm poor, I can't pay as much to have my rights protected as you can. But if I'm poor, you can't get much by violating my rights either. I don't have much to steal. And it's still the case that it's generally worth more to me not to be stolen from than it is to you to steal from me. So it is still going to be the case that the set of laws that maximize the income of the rights enforcement agency will respect both your rights and mine. Now, it is true that somebody with no income at all will not be able to buy the services of a rights enforcement agency, but then somebody with no income at all in a society with government can't buy food, and food is even more essential. If you actually look, I've never looked at the budget of the Brazilian government, but if I look at the budget for the U.S. government, it turns out that the part of its spending that goes to the equivalent of rights enforcement agencies, basically law enforcement in court, is a tiny fraction of the total budget of the U.S. government. The U.S. government taxes poor as well as rich. It's true that income tax is mostly for high-income people, but other parts of the tax system, most obviously sales taxes, are going to poor people as well. In Brazil, as I understand it, consumption taxes are most of the income of the government, and therefore the poor people are paying about the same proportion of their income as the rich people to fund the government, maybe a little less. Most of what the government is spending that money on is not rights enforcement, so I would expect that if you switched from the present system to the system I'm describing, the cost to even a poor person of rights enforcement would be much lower than the present cost to him of taxes. If you have somebody with no resources at all, if the society is sufficiently hard-hearted, he will starve to death. But in real societies, rich societies, and by historical basis, even Brazil is a rich society, although it's not as rich as the U.S. or Western Europe, and in such societies, people are very unlikely to starve because somebody will give them something. And similarly, I expect that if one person out of 1,000 really had no way at all of earning any income, that people would charitably provide to the cost of a sort of a minimal rights enforcement protection for him. So I don't see any particular reason why this system would work worse for the poor than the present system. And it seems to me that on the whole, political systems are a bad gamble for members of groups of, for groups of people who are low status and who other people don't care about them. Because it is, if you think about a society where 60% of the population think that blacks or Jews or Muslims or homosexuals or some other group are terrible people, the political system, they vote in the rules that punish people for being those things. In the economic system, 60% of the people avoid dealing with the group they don't like. The rest of them are willing to deal with them because they've got services to sell, their customers and so forth. And so the prejudices of the majority have only a fairly small effect on the people who are prejudiced against. So I would say that on the whole, if you're worried about disadvantaged groups, government is not what you want to turn to.
Do you believe that the anarcho-capitalist system will conquer the future? Do you believe in a gradualist or a socialist transition? And what do you believe is the impact of the system?
Yeah, those are several different questions. I think that something along the general lines I've described is coming into existence online, and that it's quite likely that we will have an essentially stateless system online. I do not think it is likely that we will have a stateless system in real faith in my lifetime. Probably not in your lifetime, although that's less certain, especially if we solve the aging problem, in which case some of you may have very long lifetimes, we will hope. Let's see, before there was something before Bitcoin, you had three different questions there. What was the middle one?
Do you believe in gradualism?
Right. I believe in gradualism. I think that the problem with revolutions is that a lot of the reason people believe in government is they want to be protected from violence, from murder, rape, arson, things like that. Revolutions generally involve a lot of violent conflict. Thus, a revolution tends, I think, to make people more willing to support government, not less willing to support government. And therefore, I think revolution is probably not a sensible strategy for people who believe in little or no government. I could be wrong. Different societies are different. I don't know Brazil very well, but that's my general feeling. So my view is that ideally the way you get to a free society happens sufficiently gradually that it's never quite clear when it finally happens. That more and more of the things that government has been doing get taken over by private people. Some of that has happened already. My understanding is that if you are a rich person in Brazil, it is not the police who are protecting your house. That if you are a rich person in Brazil, you are likely to live in a gated community with your own private guards. So to that extent, you have already opted out of the government, that part of the government law system. If there is a very interesting book called The Beautiful Tree, which is about private schools in societies much poorer than Brazil. The author looked at private schools in India and in Africa, and he found that in many countries, there are very inexpensive private schools. They exist in societies where there are free state schools, but the free state schools are very bad. The teachers quite often don't show up. And it is possible to provide a level of education that is a good deal better than that, very inexpensively, and that happens. If you end up in a situation where most parents are sending their children to private schools that cost them a little and do a better job than the public schools, then abolishing the public schools becomes much easier. So similarly, step by step, I would like to imagine a future where things government is doing get taken over by the private market. Once it's being done by the private market, people become less willing to vote tax money to have the government do it, and thus the government gradually fades away. There's a rather entertaining science fiction novel some of you may have read called Snow Crash, somewhat tongue-in-cheek account of a future which is basically a stateless America. And there is still a government. There are buildings full of officials. It's just that the forms they fill out don't do anything. They sort of keep coming in from out of habit. It's not clear if they're being paid or not. And that would be a nice way, where you sort of never officially abolish government. It just it doesn't matter anymore. After all, there's a good deal of the world where that's already happened to the church. England has an established church. official government church, the Church of England, but as best I can tell, most people in England don't take it very seriously. Bitcoin, right. Bitcoin is fascinating. When I was originally looking at the idea of strong privacy, of anarchy online, the forms of anonymous digital currency I was looking at all involved an actual bank somewhere that held the money, and it was the process of transferring it from one person to another was anonymous. So the bank didn't know who had their money, didn't know who they were sending it to, but eventually someone had to come back to the bank and collect. The trouble with that system is that it requires a bank in some reasonably reliable country, in some developed country with a government that people trust and so forth. Governments in countries like that don't want anonymous digital cash to exist because it reduces their ability to control people. Once you have anonymous digital cash, money laundering laws become unenforceable. Consequently, they don't want a bank established, so you never get the first step to get that. Bitcoin is a beautiful way around that problem because there's no issuer. Bitcoin does not require a bank anywhere that you trust. On the other hand, Bitcoin, as it now exists, is the least anonymous currency that has ever existed because every transaction is a matter of public record to everybody using Bitcoin. Now, it's public record between accounts, not between people. But if you use Bitcoin in a sort of simple, straightforward fashion, if somebody wants to find out which account is yours, all they have to do is to make you a payment and watch what account that money goes into. So Bitcoin, as normally used, is an ingenious replacement for government money, but it's not yet an anonymous one. And there are various proposals either for protocols used with Bitcoin or for alternatives. Blockchain currencies which get around that. So I think it is likely that either Bitcoin or something like Bitcoin will play an important role in the future. It will help to make the anarchy online work, and it will at least weaken the ability of governments in real space to control people.
Law tries to be complexity in society, and with general rules,
because what you are buying when you buy into a particular private court's rules is future application of those rules, and the more complex they are, the more you'll have to pay lawyers to figure out what you're doing. Hence, the customers are going to have a demand for reasonably simple legal rules. And that I am imagining the first step being a conflict, but since the rights enforcement agencies know they'll have future conflicts, they want to agree not on a solution to this conflict, but on a set of rules for all future conflicts, which is what the private court is offering them. Consequently, they have an incentive to produce relatively simple rules. And it is my understanding that if you look at how private arbitration works, it tends to have much simpler rules than government arbitration. In fact, I sometimes claim that there is a version of my system that already exists, but it's sort of an analog to my system, in which the equivalent of the rights enforcement agencies are auto insurance companies. That auto insurance companies have conflicts between their customers because my car dents your car. And just as rights enforcement agencies have two ways of settling their conflicts, fighting or arbitration, auto insurance companies have two ways of settling their conflicts, suing each other, which is like fighting because it's very expensive, or agreeing on arbitration. Almost all those disputes are in fact settled outside of the court by the auto insurance companies, and I am told that they have some very simple rules of deciding when an accident happens, which company is responsible for it, precisely because they want to avoid all the litigation costs that are associated with suing. So I think that you would expect some tendency to produce relatively simple legal rules, except where there is a particular need for some particular problem that needs complicated rules.
Recently, I read a book from Kenneth Edwards. The graphic book shows a and then look at that gradually steady growth. What is the market mechanism to prevent the creation of
the creation of what?
Leviathan.
Leviathan. Well, we don't have a mechanism that that prevents it. North Korea exists. Stalinist Russia existed. Such things do get created. But on the other hand, they worked very badly. And the result is that the Soviet Union eventually collapsed. North Korea, we can hope, will collapse. But at least it doesn't have, it unfortunately has atomic weapons. But it is still a very poor society. We can almost certainly build anti-missile missiles a lot faster than they can build missiles. So in general, the fact that Leviathan works badly tends to destroy it. Sometimes when Leviathan works badly and people outside of that country can see it, if people in Brazil look a little bit south of here and they can see that things aren't going very well in Venezuela, and that makes it harder for Leviathan to occur. I was at least told by one of the Brazilians I was talking about that even if Lula is not in prison at the next election, he will probably not win the election, in part because people see him as the equivalent of Chavez and they don't want Brazil to turn into Venezuela. So those are all things that limit Leviathan. Beyond that, I think part of it is technological. I suspect that one of the reasons that governments collect a much larger fraction of income in the 20th century than it did in the 19th century is that as the economy shifted to an economy where many people were working for wages, it became much easier for governments to observe income, harder to hide income. That if you're a farmer out in the Midwest somewhere, it's a little hard for the IRS to pay it to know what you're really getting, how much of your own crop you're consuming, how much of it you're selling without telling anybody. Whereas if you're an employee of a bureaucratic firm, which has got to keep track of what it's doing for its own purposes, it's harder to hide income. So it's certainly possible that technologies that make taxing people easier tend to result in larger governments, technologies that make taxing people harder in smaller governments. One of the attractive features of strong privacy online is that it makes it difficult or impossible to tax digital transactions, and that hopefully will result in governments getting less income and thus in societies being freer, one can hope. I am told that the labor laws in Brazil are terrible, but I don't live here, so I don't really know. One of the ones that I found particularly extraordinary, which is not exactly a labor law, but is a law designed to give people an income for doing something that serves no useful purpose, is that I am told that in order to get a driving license in Brazil, you have got to take 80 hours of classes before taking the exam that lets you take another 120 hours of classes before you take the driving test that lets you get a driver's license. That sounds like a waste of about 190 hours. My daughter at least reports that it took her about 10 hours in America studying the booklet that's the equivalent of your 80-hour classes that tells you what the rules are for driving. She then passed that part of the test and got her learner's permit without having to spend the other 70 hours. So that strikes me as an example of a law that exists only to get the votes of the people who teach those classes. I gather there are a bunch of other silly rules. I was told, and I'm not sure if it's still true or not, that a company must provide a month of vacation to every employee, and it has to provide it as 1 month. It can't provide 2 weeks in the summer and 2 weeks in the winter, even if the employee prefers that. So it sounds as though Brazil is a good deal farther than the U.S. is for freedom of contract, which I regard as the appropriate labor law, that the appropriate law is that when you agree to work for somebody, you agree with them on what the terms are, and if somebody else offers you more attractive terms, you take those. But again, this is based on talking to people who most of whom agree with my politics and therefore are likely to tell me the things that I want to hear, so I cannot say that I have an unbiased expert view of Brazilian labor law.
The second question. The question is about easy things that some people may be into, like bank on loan. Have structured for the idea that European middle wages were some kind of anarcho-capitalist order. And yes, what's your opinion on the medieval Europe?
It was a very interesting society. It was not as bad as 19th century people make it out to be, as far as I can tell. There were certainly some elements of competitive law, since a lot of the law was at the level of the baron, not of the king. But there was also royal law, which you didn't get out of, and you had only limited ability, having been born under one baron's law, to get to another's. So I would not say it was an anarchist utopia, but it was an interesting system. And one in which government was a good deal more decentralized than in our system, which strikes me as in some ways an attractive feature. One of the things one is often told about medieval Europe is that serfs were tied to the land, that they couldn't move. And I think that's an exaggeration. There was a very famous French medieval historian who argued, if I remember correctly, that he could find no evidence in the French sources before, I think, about the 15th century or maybe the 16th century, fairly late. And my conjecture, which I'm not sure is correct about what was going on in medieval Europe, was that the feudal dues were essentially the rent on land and the payment for legal services, but they were not set by free contract. They were traditional rules. And what limited them was that if the lord was trying to charge, as it were, more than the market rate, there was a risk that serfs would go to another lord who would offer them better terms. That what then happens starting really in the 16th century, when gold starts coming in from the New World, is that you have... No, earlier than that, I'm sorry. What happens with the plague, which is in the 14th century, I was getting my centuries confused, is the plague kills a lot of people and doesn't kill any land. And the result is that the market rent on land goes down, the market wage of labor goes up. That means that the terms for the feudal dues that were roughly the market value of what the lord was providing are now much too high. But these dues are set by custom, not by negotiation. So now all of the lords are in effect trying to charge more than the market rate. Now you get a problem of runaway serfs, because each lord has got lots of empty land because of people dying of plague. He's willing to offer more generous terms to somebody else's serfs if they'll come and settle in his land, and that makes rules preventing serfs from running away very hard to enforce. The barons go to the king and try to get official royal laws saying serfs can't run away, but have a hard time enforcing them. So I discussed this in my first published journal article in economics, was a theory of the size and shape of nations, trying to use economics to figure out why it's sometimes in European history you had big nations and sometimes small nations. And in writing that, that was my conjecture about what was really going on with medieval serfdom. But I don't swear that I'm right about it. I'm only an amateur medieval historian, also an amateur medieval cook. One of my hobbies and my wife's and my daughter's hobbies is cooking from very early cookbooks. So if you go to my webpage, one of the things you can find is the PDF of a self-published cookbook my wife and I wrote, which has 300 roughly recipes, giving you the original recipe from a medieval or Renaissance source and how we make them. But I'm not a serious medieval historian, and my interpretation of what's going on with serfdom may well be wrong.
Where did it begin, the substitution of state power by free market society?
That's going to depend on the society. Wherever the places are where the public support for the government activity is weak, and where it is practical to produce a good substitute. So if we think about schooling, if the public schools are bad enough so that people are willing to pay for private schools, And if people can produce private schools cheaply enough, people are willing to pay for them, then an important place to remove the power of government is in schooling. One intermediate proposal, which my father proposed, is a voucher system in which you say, well, if the government is willing to pay for schooling, we don't have to provide it. After all, government has food stamps to provide food to poor people, but they don't have to grow it themselves, the food you get from the grocery store. So if you shift to a system where anybody who sends his child to a private school or educates his child himself gets the money that would go to the public school for that child, then you have a system where you've got direct competition. You can then develop private schools that most people are sending their children to, at which point the idea of getting the government out of schooling becomes easier. In a different society, that might not work. There are countries where the public schools work pretty well. That's going to be much harder to replace. But those may be places where the post office works very badly. And in that case, you could say, look, allow UPS and FedEx to deliver the mail. They're doing just fine with packages. Once they can deliver the mail, why should we be subsidizing the post office when we don't need the government to do it? Another society, it might be something different. So I don't think there's a simple answer. Maybe in Brazil, people are sufficiently fed up with the requirements for the driver's license, so you get lots of votes by saying, switch to the American system, that in order to get a driver's license, you first pass a test to see if you know the laws about the driving. You then pass another test to see if you can drive. In between the two tests, you get a learner's permit, which means you can drive, but only with a licensed driver next to you in the car, so your parents can teach you how to drive. That might be popular enough that that particular bit of silliness could be eliminated from Brazil. Maybe the labor laws could be changed. I just don't know in Brazil what are the weak points. What are the places where you can push against the state? That's really a problem for you to solve, not a problem for me to solve. I can't resist telling you my learner's permit story, though. I grew up in Chicago, but we spent our summers in New Hampshire. And in Chicago, at age 15, I could get a learner's permit, and I had one. In New Hampshire, I think at age 15, you could get a driver's license, but you had to be a New Hampshire citizen, which I wasn't. New Hampshire did not recognize learner's permits. So there was no way I could legally drive in New Hampshire. I was driving our car with my father sitting next to me in New Hampshire when we were stopped by a policeman. It turned out that I had an Illinois learner's permit that was not valid in New Hampshire. My father described the situation to the policeman, and he said, all right, I want my son to learn to drive so he'll be a safe driver. There is no legal way I can do that in New Hampshire. If you were me, what would you do? And the policeman said, what you are doing, and drove off. So policemen are sometimes reasonable people, too. At least in New Hampshire. I don't know about Brazil.
The question is about how can we deal with this reality as immigration crisis, refugee crisis in Europe?
I think the solution for Europe is what I believe is the current solution for the Czech Republic. And that is you let your refugees come in, but you don't pay them anything. So that you say, refugees can come here, they can get a job, they can work, but they can't go on welfare. Because the problem with the present situation, I think, is that the European welfare systems are sufficiently generous by the standards of places like Syria or Iraq, that whether or not you're really a refugee, it may well pay you to say you are, come into those countries, and live on welfare instead of working. So if you say, if you come, you're going to have to work if you don't want to be hungry, then you will get the real refugees for whom it's bad enough at home that they're willing to come even if they have to beg, and you will get the real immigrants who can make more money working in Germany than they could make working in Syria and would rather do it. The United States, until the 1920s, the United States had almost no restrictions on immigration. I think until later than that, there were no restrictions on New World immigration. People from Brazil were free to come. There were some restrictions on Chinese immigration starting the late 19th century. During the period just before World War I, the United States had about 1 million immigrants a year coming in into a population of 100 million. So that's the equivalent of 3 million a year for the United States now, or 2 million a year for Brazil. And it was not a problem. That's when my grandparents came to America. So I think that immigration is really a problem only if you have a society which either makes it hard for immigrants to work because it's got restrictions, with the result that many of them end up working in the informal economy illegally, or in which you have generous welfare by their standards, so you have people coming in who don't want to work. And I would say that as long as you're willing to have a society where immigrants are free to take any job that's offered, to work on any terms mutually acceptable, and are not being subsidized by the state, that the solution to the immigration problem is immigration. Let them come. I proposed in my first book that if the United States was not willing to go back to its traditional policy of free immigration, we should at least send the Statue of Liberty back to France, since the Statue of Liberty has a verse on the base of it from a poem which is basically saying, send us your poor and hungry people, they are welcome here. There is a song that Joan Baez, Buffy St. Marie sings, of which the sort of part I like is, welcome, welcome, immigrante, to my country, welcome home. So that's my view of immigration from a country that is what it is because of immigration. Unfortunately, President Trump does not agree with me.
The capitalist system is subject to periodic crises like the 1929 and 2008. And how would the libertarian system deal with those crises without the government?
Well, the serious one you described was produced by the government, so that's not going to be a problem for a libertarian system. I don't have a clear enough... I don't have a clear enough idea of the reasons for the 2008 crisis. My interests in economics are not macroeconomics, not the study of inflation, depression, things like of that sort. I should say I think the terms microeconomics and macroeconomics are wrong, that the world wheat market is a problem in microeconomics. So it's not really small versus large. It's really price theory which deals with equilibrium, with the situation in which all markets clear, and disequilibrium theory, which deals with situations where you have people who want to work and can't get a job, or goods that sellers want to sell but don't get sold. And I think we understand price theory much better than we understand disequilibrium theory, and I in particular understand price theory much better than I understand disequilibrium theory. I like to say that a course in macroeconomics is a tour of either a cemetery or a construction site, that we don't really have adequate theories for that. But in the case of the Great Depression of 1929, what we know is that the Federal Reserve System was created to prevent that from happening, that the banking system, naturally enough, adjusted to the knowledge that there was a government agency that would bail them out if there was a bank run. The bank run happened and the government agency didn't bail them out. The stock of money dropped by about a third, and that seems to be why the Great Depression happened. So that's a particular case where the banking industry before the Federal Reserve had made various private arrangements in order to prevent the problem. In 18th century Scotland, where the money was produced by private banks, one solution was that what the currency set on it was something like redeemable for a tenth of an ounce of silver on demand, or we retain the option to give you a tenth of an ounce of silver plus a 10% extra 6 months later. So they were protecting themselves against a run on the bank by explicitly contracting that if they couldn't fulfill their agreement, they would fulfill it later after they had time to turn their other assets into silver and pay an extra amount to the holders. other arrangements involve banks making arrangements with each other for interbank loans. But that particular crisis was the result of the government trying to replace the free market and then the government system breaking down. The 2008 crisis was associated with the housing industry. The two largest firms in the American housing industry were Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were both created by the U.S. government. By the time the crisis occurred, they were nominally private firms, but people reasonably enough believed that if they went broke, the government would bail them down, out, and that's what actually happened. So clearly government involvement is what happened, but I cannot tell you with any confidence whether that was responsible for it or not, because I don't understand it very well. I think the evidence suggests that business cycles do occur in the free market, but that at least the really bad business cycles we know about are the results of various forms of government intervention. The other big U.S. depression occurred about a century earlier as a result of the collapse of the Second Bank of the United States, which was the bank that had been created by the U.S. government. So that's another case where it did not occur on a really free market system.
So the last question is,
Do
you have what's your view on automation if it's going to destroy jobs? O problema da ineficiência do governo é que ele não se coloca para a regulação. The problem with government inefficiency is that the government monopoly of law because they don't bother with their own regulation. E como funciona o sistema de arbitragem para pessoas que não podem pagar? What is the problem? How do you solve the problem of arbitration if people can't pay for it?
Yes. That's a whole bunch of different questions. What was the first one? Technology has been destroying jobs since at least the 18th century. At the end of the 19th century, I believe a substantial majority of the U.S. labor force was in agriculture, farming. Currently, I think about 3% of the U.S. labor force is in farming. Nonetheless, we do not observe that 47% of the population is unemployed. So I expect that what will continue to happen is that certain things there will be better and less expensive ways of doing, and people who are doing those things will not be able to keep doing that. But at the same time, since human wants are essentially unlimited, when you have labor available, there will be other things that that labor will end up doing. Now, the society might change in many ways. Technology might, for example, make incomes either more equal or less equal. If it turns out that the kinds of jobs that depended only on physical strength go away, since human beings are more unequal in their intellectual abilities than in their physical strength, you would probably get a more unequal distribution of income. You could imagine things the other way as well, so that you are going to change the economy as technology changes what people do. But as long as you don't make rules that prevent the things from changing, I would expect that there will be jobs for people, just different jobs. And what they are is very hard, what they will be is very hard to predict. What was the next in that series? As I said before, as far as I can tell, the cost to people of rights enforcement agencies will be quite a lot less than what they are now paying for taxes. So they will be better off, not worse off, than getting their rights enforcement from the government. There will presumably be a few people who can't pay anything. They're really paying not for the arbitration, but for the rights enforcement agency, which pays for the arbitration, which is the middleman. I presume that in a society with reasonably decent people in it, that if people, if you really have somebody who is a paraplegic, not who can't use his arms or his legs and has no way of earning money, that there will be charities to raise the money to provide him with food and to provide some level of rights and support for such people. If you have a very poor society, then people who have nothing at all are likely to starve to death well before they get killed by murderers. But fortunately, the societies we live in are not that poor, and the people in the societies are not that generous, that ungenerous. Yes?
Last question, what's your opinion on child labor?
Let me go back a step and suggest that that long series of questions suggests the downside of telling somebody this is the last question. They may try to get a whole bunch in. I think that on the whole, child labor by children who are willing to do it ought to be permitted. I think that we think of child labor in the 19th century as a terrible thing, but of course in the 19th century people were a great deal poorer than they are now, and the alternative to child labor might well be that the family couldn't eat. That child labor on the farm has long been a part of ordinary farming. There is certainly a potential problem of parents mistreating their children. On the other hand, of all the adults out there, the parents are the ones least likely to mistreat a child, since parents usually care for their children. And I think that it is a desirable thing that children be able to learn skills, not in the context of going to a school where somebody says, study this today, and 10 years from now it'll be useful to you, but in the context of actually learning to do something. If you want to learn computer programming, in my view, the best way is not to read through a book on a language, but to have a program you want to write, to read enough of the book to figure out how to start writing it, and then to keep reading other chapters step by step as you need to do things you couldn't do before. And similarly, I think that somebody who is delivering newspapers and being paid for it, which used to be the traditional paper boy, the traditional thing that, you know, 12-year-old boys did to get some spending money, is learning useful skills, and is more likely to become part of the market. Aside from child labor, one of the problems with minimum wage laws, especially when they are high, is that they prevent teenagers from getting their first job because they aren't worth very much for their first job, and the result is they never get their second job. So in general, I think that I can imagine circumstances in which protecting children from their parents is worth doing, but on average, I think children usually need protection from everybody except their parents. I know that one of the questions which often comes up, not quite the same question as child labor, is what do you do about child abuse by their parents? Quite a long time ago, when I was a law school professor, we were interviewing somebody we were thinking of hiring, who when he was a law school student had been one of the ones who was providing volunteer legal services to poor people. And I asked him, it turned out that most of those services were helping the poor people interact with the government. And I asked him whether in terms of his experience, the rules that allowed the government to take children away from their parents when their parents were mistreating them produced net benefit or net loss. And he said he couldn't say for the country as a whole, but for Ithaca, New York, which is where his law school was, they produced net loss. They made children worse off, not better. That the people who take the children away, on average, care less for the children's welfare. And if you're sufficiently curious, if you go to my blog is set up so you can search it for keywords. And if you search it for the word FL, for the initials FLDS, you will find the account of an episode a few years ago in which the child protection people of the state of Texas took 300 children away from their parents because they did not like the parents' religion. That's not what they said they were doing, but that's what they actually did. They eventually gave them back after both the appeals court and the Texas Supreme Court unanimously ruled that what they were doing was illegal. So I think that in general, transferring control over children from their parents to the state, there are times when it would be good, when the parents are bad enough, but on average it's likely to be bad.
Since now we have
Aha. I've talked to people from Lenovo in Brazil, but I'm really not confident to judge whether they will do a competent job, whether they'll do the right things or not. Libertarian Party in the U.S., I have long argued that its function is not ultimately to elect libertarian legislators. Its function is to get libertarian ideas enough attention so the other parties will steal them. That my father used to argue that the most successful political party in America was the Socialist Party. The Socialist Party, I think, never elected anybody more important than the mayor of the city of Milwaukee. But if you compare the platform of the Socialist Party at the beginning of the 20th century with the platforms of the Republican and the Democratic parties at the end of the 20th century, you observe that they got most of what they wanted, because the various programs that they supported became sufficiently popular that it paid the major parties. And on one occasion, I think I was giving a speech to a Libertarian Party audience, where I said that basically, if the Libertarian Party ever got a lot of votes, it would probably stop being Libertarian, because it would then pay people to try to buy it, to try to bribe Libertarian politicians to do the things those people wanted. But that wasn't likely to happen, because it started getting very many votes. It would lose its issues to other parties that would want those votes. And that you might think of the Libertarian Party as sort of like a soda can that you throw away after you use it. That its function would be fulfilled at the point when it was no longer needed because the other parties were being Libertarian. And for some reason, the presidential candidate of the Libertarian Party did not respond positively to that description of the party. I cannot understand what Ed Clark had against it, but he didn't seem to like it.
We have them for the excellent event, okay?
Thank you for the excellent audience.